Good evening, friends. This is Franz Weinschenk welcoming you to Valley Writers Read, a program where you hear the voices of only Valley writers and authors. And tonight, we're going to feature a really historically and culturally important program that we broadcast in 2006, featuring the work of Wilma Elizabeth McDaniel, the most famous writer among the hundreds of thousands of Midwestern sharecroppers who, around the mid-1930s, left their Dust Bowl homes and migrated to California. That's the same group of people that John Steinbeck wrote about in The Grapes of Wrath, only he wasn't one of them. She was. And toward the end of the program, you'll actually hear her voice. Wilma Elizabeth McDaniel herself will be reading a poem of hers. To get us started, let's listen to three of Wilma McDaniel's poems. The first one, California Nativity, then California Entertainment, and finally, Changing Soap, all written in the mid to late 1930s. Our reader is John Doffelmeyer.
California Nativity. Little Buster loved Merced so much in the year 1936, he thought it was another Bethlehem, Jesus born again. It's always Christmas there, he told the credulous Portuguese kids, lights and pretties everywhere, you look, even in summer. Only now it was December, with tinsel strung above the street, a Salvation Army lassie ringing a needy bell. Buster paused beside her. The lassie smiled, and he took a penny from his overall pocket, one he'd saved for Tootsie Rolls, and dropped it in the kettle. Afterward, he pondered his behavior. "Don't know why I done it," he told us, "but something come over me, and I forgot about my candy." California Entertainment, 1936. No cotton picking that day. It poured rain the night before and washed out everything but the tent pegs on Uncle Bart's most precious dreams. They came out next morning as bright as the valley sun, but the fields were soggy wet. No complaining from a man with seven hungry children. He laughed and he told little Clemmy, "Boy, you and me is going up among the swells on Sycamore. See how they live from outside." They crossed the railroad tracks and stood beneath the Coca-Cola sign beside Highway 99. Never even got to Sycamore. Instead, they watched cars go by for hours, counted seven license plates they had never seen before. Changing Soap, 1935. Gino, the vineyard boss, said he had a date that night and let everyone quit work early. Zona walked slowly home with grape-color sweat oozing from her pores and carrying a secret. Outside her tent, with hanging fern in a lard bucket, she called to barefoot handmaidens. "Draw me a bath, little children, in the old zinc tub. Bring me the towel that Billy Hawk stole from Traveler's Hotel in Phoenix. And toss me that new cake of ivory from my candy box on the shelf. I've moved up, little children, from using yellow soap."
That was John Duffelmeyer reading three poems by Wilma Elizabeth McDaniel, California Nativity, then California Entertainment, and finally, Changing Soap. Next, we'll hear The Ketchup Bottle by Wilma Elizabeth McDaniel, as read by Terry Phillips. This story was brought to our attention by Trudy Wisherman, who'll be reading a piece of her own later on this season. Trudy shared with us why this story is so important to her.
I remember where I was when I first read The Ketchup Bottle. I was in my office in Davis late at night, typing the story for its author, Wilma Elizabeth McDaniel, as I had typed so many of her other pieces. It was early 1992, near the end of a humanities project I'd been conducting in the San Joaquin Valley, with a traveling photo exhibit on farm workers and the need to schedule events around that exhibit to help bring its meaning home. Jerry Haslam had introduced me to her work early on, but I didn't actually get to meet her until midway through. The impact of that meeting was dramatic. I loved her poems right off, but her actual person grounded them in the landscape, and I could no longer travel through the valley without looking for her characters and landmarks and seeing them. But hearing The Ketchup Bottle in my mind as I typed it that night set the hook in my decision to move my life and work into the valley, in particular to Lindsay. The story takes place on the Tulare-Lindsay Highway, at an old house sitting lightly beneath the shade of a chinaberry tree and a Modesto ash, on a hot summer afternoon, and I swear that when I travel that road, I still find myself looking for the house, even though Wilma says it's not there anymore. It's a mundane story, sometimes aggravatingly slow, but so true to the pace of those unending hot days and the lives of so many people living through them, I consider it to be nonfiction. And it's a story about a conversion I myself was in need of at the time, a turning or returning toward a value system and a way of life 180 degrees off the beaten path. I see this story as a tribute to this place and to the influence of one woman who's been sketching its human landscapes for almost 70 years.
The Ketchup Bottle by Wilma Elizabeth McDaniel. Tulare's welfare department faced old Highway 99, where the highway curved S-shaped into town. The building didn't look like a place that could provide much in the way of relief for the needy. It was antiquated and ugly. Originally, it had housed the old snooker parlor and saloon, and still bore traces of its early green paint. Joe, the janitor, once aptly described the color as pukey green. Local citizens had long petitioned the County Board of Supervisors for a new building, even a larger, older building that could be adapted for office space. At its last budget meeting, the supervisors voted to reject Tulare's request. Instead, they allotted funds for a large new building in the Dinuba area. Joe was heard to remark, "Tulare don't have no clout. Them supervisors know where the money is. Everything is moving out of here to the northeast side of the county." Employees of the Tulare department experienced an emotional slump after their last rejection. They would simply have to carry on their work in the same old cramped quarters. It just didn't seem fair, what with the increasing number of clients they were serving. Harley Burns was one of those frustrated employees, a social worker among the poor and elderly in his district. He now sat behind his desk in a cubbyhole office. He shuffled papers, squirmed, and scuffed his feet, feeling trapped. This place was too crowded for interviewing people, even more docile types. His present client did not fit that category. A thin, grayish man of 50, he had been difficult from the moment he entered. His breathing was labored. When he sat down across from Harley, he simply stated in a coarse voice, "I need more money." He then listened silently to Harley's explanation of the welfare system with no change of expression. His hands shook as if he might need a drink. Finally, he took out his car keys and jangled them nervously. This action annoyed Harley. He looked down at the man's file on the desk and spoke. Sir, I'm going to have to deny your request for an increase in benefits. There was a heavy silence. Harley stood up. Sir, I'm afraid this is the best I can do. The man did not get up from his chair immediately. He looked at Harley with ice-cold eyes and told him, Sonny, don't do me great favors. There was contempt in his voice. He stood up, breathing heavily, and stalked out into the hall. A woman had waited for him on a bench outside the door. They began talking. Harley could plainly overhear their conversation. The man cursed the entire welfare system, using special epithets for social workers such as himself. He was still cursing until he got out of earshot. This particular interview had been jarring to Harley. He sat down and thought about the man's cursing. He had been an agonized person. It occurred to him that he had not cursed to any extent since 1956. That was the year he got saved in a tent revival south of Tulare when he was 14. He looked at the calendar on his desk. This was 1977. His conversion took place 21 years ago. He wondered in dull amazement how his behavior could have ever been so incredibly holy. Then he wondered why on earth he was thinking of those days at all. He shook his head of memories, further tousling his heavy reddish hair. He was overdue for a haircut because his barber had gone to Texas for a 3-week vacation. He felt a smudge on his glasses and removed them. He blew on them, cleaned them with tissues, and wished again that he had brown eyes instead of gray-green cat eyes. It was silly, as he could not tell himself why he preferred brown eyes. There was a movement in the hall. Rudy Mendez, a fellow social worker, stuck his head inside the door and called, "Vamos comer, Barnes," then hurried down the hall. Harley sat up straight. It was lunchtime, and he would have to get something to eat. He pulled out a case file and secured it on his clipboard, put on his prescription sunglasses. He left the cubicle, thankful to be freed briefly from its confines. He trailed 2 women workers down the hall and left the building by the back door. The heat smote him. He got in his car and put the clipboard on the seat. The plastic seat covers burned, and he wished he'd covered the seats with terry cloth. He started driving down Tulare Street. The temperature sign above Acme Savings and Loan read 102 degrees. Harley snapped on the radio. The announcer predicted a high of 106 degrees is being forecast for the San Joaquin Valley today. He snapped off the radio in disgust and turned down the street toward the A&W root beer stand. Suddenly, the air conditioning went off in the car. His instant impulse was to swear roundly. He pushed the air conditioning button, pulled it out, pushed it again, but nothing happened. His nylon shirt felt like a hot sheath encasing his torso, and his stomach was queasy. He rolled down the window but remained nauseated. Eating was out of the question for now. He glanced down at the clipboard on the seat beside him, decided that he might as well use his lunch hour to work. Maybe he could locate the recipient whose case had been assigned to him. He circled back to Tulare Street and headed east on the Lindsay Highway. He drove fast, feeling some relief as the hot air blew in his face. He began to check numbers on mailboxes and slowed down as he approached a red frame house. Directions on the clipboard described such a house on the right side of the highway. He signaled and turned off into a dusty driveway. He was glad for the luxury of a huge Modesto ash and parked his car in its deep shade. He sat in the car for a few seconds, studying the scene before him. His first impression was that the house needed a fresh coat of paint, but that the yard was beautifully kept. He observed the freshly mowed lawn and the profusion of flowers. They were everywhere. An old graniteware tea kettle held a wild array of rose moss in many exotic colors. There were tubs of hens and chickens and other succulents, and several Crisco cans of Wandering Jew. He noticed a bamboo rake leaned against the side of the house, and a garden hose lay neatly coiled under a chinaberry tree. He got out of the car and was surprised that he had not been challenged by a barking dog. Most welfare recipients had dogs, often vicious animals. He glanced at both sides of the house and decided to make his move. He walked resolutely across the lawn and up on a small porch. One side of it was covered by the Modesto ash. Its shade felt refreshing to his warm body. He stood there and adjusted the clipboard under one arm, then rang the doorbell. There was no answer. He rang again. He couldn't hear the bell ringing inside the house, although the front door was open. He knocked sharply on the door facing, three times, and waited for a response. In a few seconds, he heard a shuffling sound that moved toward the door. Someone was coming. He waited. The shuffling ceased. From the dimness of the room, a quavering voice said, "Howdy, sir," through the screen door. Harley immediately assumed his usual patronizing attitude. He spoke with the mock courtesy which he used 5 days a week to earn his living. "Are you Mrs. Harrison?" The weak voice answered,
"Yes, sir."
Harley said blandly, "I am Harley Burns. I have been assigned to investigate your eligibility to continue receiving old age assistance. May I come in?" He did not wait for an answer, but pulled the door open and stepped inside a small living room. The screen door made a flapping sound as it closed behind him. The weak voice ventured,
"That old door needs fixing. The spring is broke. Won't you sit down? Take that rocking chair."
In the cool dimness of the room, he saw that Mrs. Harrison was a tall, thin woman, considerably taller than his 5'4". Somehow, that fact annoyed him. Mrs. Harrison motioned him to a high-backed rocker. Above it was a large ceramic plaque inscribed with, "We know all things work together for good to them that love God." Mrs. Harrison waited until Harley dropped down into the rocker. Then she sat down opposite him on a sagging couch. It was almost totally covered with a bright Indian blanket and had several silk-top pillows in one corner. Harley noted that a large picture of the Good Shepherd hung on the wall behind the couch. It seemed to him that the shepherd's compassionate eyes were gazing directly into his. The rocker proved to be very comfortable. He felt himself relax and gave a sigh of relief. After all, he was on his lunch break. The fruity aroma of baking drifted to him from the kitchen. It smelled like berry pie had dripped juice down into the oven. These old women from the Southwest all baked delicious things. Harley reckoned, mentally, that cooking was about all they had to do now that they were pensioned off. They no longer had to worry about money. Mrs. Harrison scuffed her bedroom slippers against the linoleum rug and stifled a cough. Harley straightened up quickly and began to shuffle the papers on the clipboard to reassure her. "Let's see where we are. Better start at the beginning with your full name. It's Bertha Ellen Harrison, isn't it?"
"Yes, sir."
"You are a widow?"
"Yes, sir."
"How long has your husband been dead?"
20 years.
"Do you live alone?"
"Yes, sir."
Harley scribbled her answers on a form. Suddenly, a clock chimed in the background. Harley was startled. "Say, that's an old grandfather clock, isn't it? Chimes every 15 minutes. It's right on the dot with my bull of a watch." Mrs. Harrison said carefully,
"It belonged to my father. It's over 100 years old.
Harley looked squarely into her face and really saw her for the first time. She had a sensitive quality to her face and large dark eyes behind rimless glasses. Her heavy iron-gray hair was piled on top of her head. The style reminded Harley of the preacher's wife who wore hers the same way. Why did such memories keep popping up at him today? He deliberately shut them off and asked, "How is your health, Mrs. Harrison? I see your ankles are quite swollen. Do you have water retention?"
"Yes, sir. That's what the doctor told me. I take a pill for it every day."
Mrs. Harrison looked down at her puffy feet and ankles in felt bedroom slippers. She smoothed her cotton print dress and waited for the next question. Her thin lips trembled once. Her dark eyes seemed to beseech Harley to be brief with the interview. It was almost as if she might be afraid of him. Harley felt momentary pity for the woman. Then the memory of the tent revival conversion receded far back in his conscience. He knew what he was going to do. Since no one else would ever know about it, he was going to ask this dear, quavering old lady for a piece of that fresh pie. He said brightly, "My, you are a grand cook. I have never smelt anything so good in my life. Would you take pity on a poor bachelor and give me a taste of whatever that is you are baking? I haven't had lunch yet." Mrs. Harrison rose from the couch with some effort, but with obvious relief to leave the room. She drew a deep breath and said, "Oh, that there is a boysenberry cobbler from my own berries. I'll bring you a bowl of it. Would you like some real cow cream on it?"
"Pour it on, please."
"I've got plenty. My neighbor gives it to me from their ranch. It sure beats store-bought cream."
It was the longest effort that Mrs. Harrison had made toward conversation. She turned and walked out of the room with a slightly hobbling gait. Once more, Harley noticed her swollen ankles. This looked something like a case of gout that he once saw in another client. He decided to make himself comfortable while Mrs. Harrison was in the kitchen. Why not go whole hog? He pulled off his tie and placed it on an end table. He drew up a hassock and planted his feet on it, then stretched and sighed with pure comfort. He told himself that he had accidentally stumbled into an oasis in the desert. It was amazing, incredible. He had not realized that there was such an atmosphere left in the United States. Here in one poor house was kindness, serenity, piety, honor, and good cooking. It was the very opposite of the society in which he lived. He half sighed and wished that he could shut out his everyday life, forget the often inhuman mess of California welfare. Harley felt his temples throb. His memories were making him almost physically sick. He glanced up at the tranquil face of the Good Shepherd, whose eyes were still on him. He wished that he could be tranquil, but his thoughts darted back to the day that he came to an agreement with himself. He was pushing 40 years old and not especially gifted in any respect. He would hang on with the welfare department until he could retire. His brave new start was far behind him, along with shaking tambourines in the big revival tent. "Well, that's in the past," he muttered to himself, knowing in his heart that the past is never really past. His reverie was broken by the shuffling sound of Mrs. Harrison's bedroom slippers down the hall. He sat up straight in the rocker and put his feet on the floor. He would leave the tie off until he finished eating. Be really comfortable. Mrs. Harrison stepped over the threshold. She carried a TV table, which she set down beside Harley. Her balance was slightly wobbly, and she put one hand on the rocker to steady herself. Harley saw her unsteady movement. "Are you okay, Mrs. Harrison?"
"Yes, I get a little tipsy sometimes."
Mrs. Harrison caught her own remark and flushed slightly, adding,
"But it's not from drinking. It's something in my inner ear, so the doctor told me."
Harley looked at the tray with amazed delight. It was spread with a snowy dish towel that hung down around it like a luncheon cloth. Berry cobbler was heaped high in a willow-ware soup bowl. A Betty Crocker spoon lay beside it, and a squat pitcher held heavy cream. Mrs. Harrison encouraged him timidly,
"Just tuck that cloth napkin around your neck to protect your shirt."
Harley reached for the napkin, but he felt loath to mix the humiliating questions of welfare with his pleasure in eating this poor woman's food. He did not want those dark eyes beseeching him when he poured cream on his cobbler. He resorted to his professional manner again. "Mrs. Harrison, why don't you dig up all your receipts, utility bills, bank books, and the like, and get them ready for me while I eat this wonderful lunch?"
"That's a good idea. You make yourself at home."
Mrs. Harrison was already turning around. She left the room slowly and went down the narrow hall toward the kitchen. Two bedrooms led off the hall. Mrs. Harrison entered the one on the right and left the door open. Harley could hear her pulling out drawers. She was talking aloud to herself, as if she had misplaced something. An object dropped rather heavily upon the floor. Well, that was tough. Why couldn't people put their papers in a safe place and leave them there? Harley poured cream lavishly over the cobbler and took a huge bite. It was the first time that he had tasted cobbler. He decided instantly that it was the most delicious dessert he had ever eaten. He took another equally huge bite, remembering that his own mother never made dessert. He took a third bite and recalled painfully that his mother didn't make much of anything else in the way of food. She opened canned soup and brought down a box of crackers at mealtime. He poured more cream on the cobbler. Better make the very most of this treat. He carefully scraped out the very last purplish bit and put the spoon in the bowl. Mrs. Harrison returned, breathing heavily. She carried a plastic bag filled with receipts and papers. She sank down on the couch, holding the bag on her lap.
"Soon as I get my breath, I'll dump these papers out and find what we need."
"No hurry at all." Harley put on his tie without Mrs. Harrison even observing his action. His throat had begun to feel dry from the sweet cobbler. He needed a drink of water the worst way. He looked across at Mrs. Harrison, ruffling her myriad papers and receipts. It would be risky to ask her to bring him a glass of water. She was a sick woman, and he knew by her case history that she was 85. She might easily keel over from any extra exertion. Better take care of this thirst himself. He said in his working voice, "Mrs. Harrison, I'm thirsty from your marvelous cobbler. I'll just scoot out to the kitchen and get a drink of water from the sink. No, don't get up. I'll find a glass." Before Mrs. Harrison could reply, he rose and strode down the hall and into the kitchen. The room was immaculate from ceiling to the warm beige linoleum. Pots of African violets lined the window ledges, and starched curtains were tied back at the windows. Harley wondered how such an infirm woman could wash windows that crystal clear. He opened a cupboard door and found a row of sparkling glasses. He took one and went to the sink to turn on the faucet. It was then that he saw it. In the bottom of the sink lay the dirtiest ketchup bottle that anyone could ever imagine. It was a large, distinctive bottle, and about one-third full of dried ketchup. The label was mostly covered with the dry, darkish stuff, and the neck of the bottle heavily ringed with it. It appeared to have been rescued from an ash heap, as ashes still adhered to it. Harley was stunned at the sight in the kitchen. He could not reconcile the bottle with anything else in the beautifully kept house, or for that matter, anything about Mrs. Harrison. He did not touch the bottle, but ran water into his glass and drank thirstily. It was cool and refreshing. He had another half glass of it. At this point, Mrs. Harrison tottered into the kitchen. She was half crying and had a bluish ring around her lips. She came to the sink and said, "Oh, I am so ashamed. I didn't want anyone to see this awful, dirty bottle in my sink. I hid it there when I heard someone knocking at the front door." Harley felt alarmed over her agitation. She might become really ill from it. He tried to soothe her feelings with an endearing title. "Why, Grandma, you have every right to put your ketchup bottle where you please." Mrs. Harrison was aghast. "Oh, this isn't my bottle. I have a young neighbor who collects ketchup bottles. I found this one in the alley just before noon. It's a little different from any I ever saw before. I was going to scrub it up nice and clean and give it to her." She looked down at the bottle. "I am not boasting, but I never had anything this filthy dirty in my house before. No, sir, I'm poor, but I'm as clean as soap and water can wash things." Harley agreed in his soothing tone. "You are super clean, in a class by yourself." He looked at the rows of violets on the sink ledge and marveled at their texture, like pink and purple velvet. "Grandma, these flowers look so delicate. Aren't they hard to raise? Do you have to give them special care?"
They are a lot hardier than they might appear. Once I get them started, they don't require much care, just light and water and moderate warmth.
She added,
I started all of these from two plants my niece gave me at Easter 3 years ago.
Harley had been standing with the glass still in his hand. He set it down on the sink. He must get to the business for which he was making this visit. "Shall we go back to the living room and work on your papers? It shouldn't take long." He added quickly, "If you feel too tired, I can come back in the morning when it's cool." Mrs. Harrison seemed to have regained some composure. She said with conviction,
"I would rather that we finish this while you're here. Get it over with."
She turned around and started down the hall. Harley said, "I understand that," and took a last look at the ketchup bottle. It represented more than a bottle. He saw that clearly. Sometime he would unravel all of the many things the bottle represented, sort them out in his mind, for his own satisfaction. For now, he left the kitchen and followed Mrs. Harrison down the hall to the living room. He sat down beside her on the couch and repeated, "This won't take long. No time at all."
"I sure hope it won't take long. I guess I'm just a nervous woman and can't help it. I never was used to asking other folks to do anything for me. It goes against my grain, worries me, even at my age, having to sign papers and that kind of stuff. Upsets me."
Harley was getting the papers organized. "Don't you worry," he said without looking up. "I've got all your receipts here. I'll just check off a few more things, then have you sign in four places, and I'll be out of here." Harley felt her relief, as well as his own. He added, "I won't bother you again for 6 months, unless you call me for something." Mrs. Harrison sat rigidly and watched Harley's pen rapidly check the papers. "I think that completes our information." Harley handed her two sheets of paper. "Just sign your name on all the places I have marked X." Mrs. Harrison's hand trembled badly, but she managed to sign the papers.
"Looks like hen scratching," she lamented.
"No, ma'am, you still write better than I do." Harley took the papers and stood up. "I'll be going now, Mrs. Harrison. Thank you for the best lunch I ever had. I'll never forget it." Mrs. Harrison's dark eyes glistened with tears.
"You sure are welcome."
"Well, don't get up. I know my way out." Harley felt the eyes of the Good Shepherd following him through the door and out to the yard. He got in the car and felt the heat from the plastic seat covers. Quite a contrast from the dim coolness of Mrs. Harrison's house with its swamp coolers. He backed out of the driveway and turned back toward town with the windows rolled down. The air was even hotter than it had been 1 hour and 20 minutes ago. Have to get that air conditioning worked on. He passed a Coca-Cola truck with rattling bottles. It conjured a hurtful image from the past. He saw a mustard jar with darkened, dried-out contents. Beside it was an hourglass-shaped syrup bottle. Blobs of syrup had hardened on the outside. Harley now recalled trying to lift the bottle from a tabletop, where it was stuck fast. Bottles. He saw the way people handled bottles, showed how they viewed themselves and handled their lives. Mrs. Harrison was a striking example of that. His mother was another example. He remembered the eyes of the Good Shepherd again. He wondered if, somewhere among his belongings, he still had that holy card. The preacher gave it to him the night he got saved in the tent revival. It had a picture of Jesus with a reddish beard carrying a very woolly lamb. He needed the lamb.
We all know of something just out of our reach, gold and afloat in the sky. Redemption just one step ahead as we teach. Our children will know by and by. Grandma is singing so far in the past. A thunderous present is moving too fast. Has humankind ever been kind? Our poets will tell us, we'll listen at last. Of dying novel memories asleep in the grass. dreaming back simpler times. The quiet of morning reminds us to send hope for a world more sublime, along with the breath of a Prince Albert wind and dreams of a simpler time. Grandma's a-singing so far in the past, the thunderous present is moving too fast. Has humankind ever been kind? Our poets will tell us, we'll listen at last, of dying novel memories asleep in the grass, dreaming back simpler times. Our poets will tell us, we'll listen at last, it wasn't so simple, but lie in that grass and dream us some simpler times.
That was Montana artist Bill LaCroix with an excerpt from his song Simpler Times. Before that, Terry Phillips read The Ketchup Bottle. And now here again is John Doffelmeyer reading a few more of Wilma's poems. Prince Albert Wind, Men Waiting to be Seated at Denny's, and After Reading Obituary.
A Prince Albert Wind. He doesn't come to me on Sundays in his good suit and black string tie, piously carrying a Bible. Never. But place me in a Saturday town of khaki men with southwest faces and rich slow tongues, and Papa will blow around the nearest corner on a Prince Albert Wind, carrying a little poke of candy, maybe jelly beans. He will spot me with no trouble, smile confidently and say, "Sister, you want to go eat a bowl of chili at Poor Boy's Cafe?" I will get up from the bench in front of J.C. Penney's and go meet him, as I always do. Men waiting to be seated in Denny's. Two men from the IRS walked in on easy legs for morning coffee. The next fellow strode in like a man who has fiddled and danced to some very hard tunes and resined the bow himself. He could be John Carradine in The Grapes of Wrath, with Bible verses on his tongue. He could be my cousin Cleet, weathered, lean, wearing a rhinestone belt and rattlesnake boots. He could be Adam from the Garden of Eden, if Adam ever wore a Stetson and long sideburns. That blonde waitress coming with a pot of coffee could be his Eve, working the breakfast shift. After Reading Obituary. The local paper had only the most brief announcement. I couldn't quite place the deceased in my past. Then the name Viola Gully came back to me from the old house on Sycamore. I remember she covered her couch with an Indian blanket and had two pictures on the wall. One was a sad blue Jesus praying in Gethsemane. The other was Bob Wills, white Stetson on his head, big cigar in his mouth. Both pictures should have told me something, but I was so young. It took years to understand what I saw hanging in that poor room.
That was John Duffelmeyer reading three poems by Wilma Elizabeth McDaniel, Prince Albert Wind, Men Waiting to be Seated at Denny's, and After Reading Obituary. Just a comment about that poem, Prince Albert Wind. Prince Albert was a favorite cut tobacco that came in a red tin can with a likeness of Britain's Prince Albert on the front of the can. Like another favorite, Bull Durham, just about all the men from the Midwest in those days used to roll their own cigarettes using mostly those two brands of tobacco. Wilma Elizabeth McDaniel has written a number of poetry collections. Sister Vida's Song, 1982. A Primer for Beaufort, 1990. The Girl from Button Willow, 1990. And A Prince Albert Wind, in 1994. No show about Wilma Elizabeth McDaniel would be complete without the poet herself reading some of her own work. Here she is with a poem from a long, long time ago entitled Hoeing Cotton in High Heels.
I wrote this poem thinking about what a farm woman told me. She was a Texan. Not all my stories are based on Oklahomans. But she said, for his own reasons, her husband liked her to wear high heels all the time. And I've thought about that several times. It's a wonder that someone didn't hear that she had shot him. He wanted her to wear high heels. So out of that, I wrote this poem. Hoeing cotton in high heels. Until last Saturday afternoon, the skies of Big Muddy had been wide enough for Cyrus. Heaven had been near enough. The wondrous world carried him along with no hard thinking on his part. He was in that blissful state, wearing ice cream pants, when he bought a ticket at the new Rialto and a bag of popcorn. Sitting in the second row, luxuriating in the upholstered seat, his imagination exploded when he saw Clara Bow dancing on a tabletop in high heels. He stayed and saw the movie twice and began to run a high fever. He finally left the theater with dizzy visions from the magic screen, laughing painted girls, bobbed hair, and short skirts, always wearing high heels. Out on the Saturday street was reality. Knotted hair and gingham women. He saw his mother with a basket on her arm. Cotton stockings and sturdy shoes were right for her. But he could never forget silken legs on the silver screen. The new woman was here to stay. But he pondered how the girls of Big Muddy could hoe cotton in high heels.
California kid gal, my California kid gal, in a cloud of dust she came, forever to remain, a California kid gal. California gal, California Okie gal,
Life ain't been no bed of roses. They all look down their noses at my California Okie, yeah.
We want to thank all of our readers tonight, John Doffelmeyer, Trudy Wisherman, and Terry Phillips. And also we want to thank Wilma herself for the many contributions to our valleys and indeed our national treasure of literature. Wilma, like Steinbeck's Jode family, came to California on a journey of despair and hope. Your poems, Wilma, tell the story of that generation. Thank you for your poetry and also for that great story.
California, Okie gal. California, Okie gal. Life ain't been no bed of roses. They all look down their noses at my California, Okie gal. California, Okie gal. California, Okie gal. In a cloud of dust she came. Forever to remain a California Okie gal. In the cloud of dust she came. Forever to remain a California Okie gal.
Pat the Hat from Hanford, California, performing an excerpt from his musical tribute to Wilma Elizabeth McDaniel. California, Okie gal. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Joel Pickford. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.